Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we've got a review of the latest film from director Richard Linklater. It's Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space-Age Childhood. After that, we're starting a new series. About once a year, we do a series on classic cinema, and this year, we're looking at film noir. Over the next four episodes, classic film genius Rance Collins will join us to look at some of the best films out of the noir era, starting this week with a masterpiece called The Third Man. Don't go anywhere. If you're a big fan of movies, then you probably like to show that off from time to time with some nice movie-themed clothing. Well, Art House Garage has you covered with t-shirts, hoodies, and more from our brand new web store. Launched just a few weeks ago, we have designs that say, "Watch old movies," and "Movies are for everyone." And the cool thing about it is, if you see a design you like, you can then order that in any color of shirt, or you can have it printed on a hoodie, or a coffee mug, or a journal, or a throw pillow. Just about anything your heart desires. My next film journal, once I fill up the one I'm using now, is going to come from our shop. I think I'll go with a design that says, "Keep it snob free," as a reminder to myself and anyone who sees it. Check out the shop now at arthousegarage.com/shop, or find a link in the show notes.
Where's our kid?
Mission? For what?
We accidentally built the lunar module. A little too small.
How'd that happen?
Listen, are you good at math?
Yeah.
Do you get a perfect 100 on every test?
No.
Okay. We need a kid like you to test this accidentally smaller version on the lunar surface and soon.
Stan, you're our only hope.
Okay.
Great.
Let's forget about all this for now. We'll come back to this part later.
First, let me tell you about life back then. Living in the Houston area in the late 60s, it was a great time and place to be a kid. Awesome! But the world was changing, and so was how we saw ourselves in it.
Right on.
Mom, is that one a hippie?
Yeah, that's a hippie.
How about that one?
No, his hair's not long enough.
But he's wearing bell bottoms.
Okay, that's a hippie.
I think I like hippies.
That was the trailer for a film called Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space-Age Childhood. This is the latest from director Richard Linklater, who also made films like Boyhood, The Before Trilogy, and School of Rock. This film is also animated, in the same unique style as two of his other films, Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly. The animation technique is called rotoscoping, and it involves filming the action of a scene, and then creating animation out of that by tracing each frame. This process used to be done by hand, but now there are digital ways to produce the same effect. This leads to a really unique visual style that is incredibly lifelike, while still allowing for the bright colors we tend to associate with animation, and the occasional breaking the rules of reality with little flourishes that couldn't be created in camera. And this style works well for the nostalgic subject matter of Apollo 10 and a Half, which is based on the childhood of Richard Linklater himself. The film follows a young boy named Stan, who is the Linklater stand-in, who lives near Houston, Texas. At the beginning of the film, in the year 1969, two NASA recruiters visit Stan at school and tell him they need a child astronaut because they mistakenly built the space shuttle a little too small, and Stan has been selected to undergo top secret training and fly the shuttle to the moon. At this point, the story pauses, and then we're taken back a few months to learn all about Stan's life before this NASA recruiting occurred. Our narrator is adult Stan in the future, played by Jack Black. Looking back at his family life and the culture of the 1960s, in surprising detail, like an incredible amount of detail, it's less like watching a narrative film and more like reading a journal. For the first half of the film, adult Stan tells us about the TV shows he watched, the films that were popular, music, sports, what school was like, what his neighborhood was like, and what he spent his time doing. These are all recounted without any overarching story, but in little snippets that flow from one to the next. At about the halfway point, we catch back up to the NASA story and see the young Stan training for his secret mission, and we also see his experience of the actual events surrounding Apollo 11. It's an odd little film, a marriage of nostalgia and childhood fantasy, and it's a film I'm very glad I've seen. It certainly fits into the rest of Linklater's filmography in a few ways. First, thematically, questions of memory and how humans experience the passage of time have always been vital themes for Linklater, and Apollo 10 and a half uniquely furthers these ideas with the act of looking back, and looking back at length and in detail. Near the end of the film, Stan's mother gives sort of the climactic line of dialogue. I won't spoil it, but it has to do with this very subject matter of how memory works. This film also feels like a Linklater project because of the way it eschews a traditional narrative structure. Some of his other works are similarly without a conventional beginning, middle, and end, like his film Dazed and Confused, which is, of course, the ultimate hangout movie. It would rather drop you into a world and let you experience it, rather than taking you on a journey with ups and downs like we're used to from most cinematic storytelling. This film follows a similar pattern, that is, there's not much of a story. And that really suits Apollo 10 and a half, although I don't think this film works quite as well as some of his others. There's definitely a sense in a few moments that some of the details we're getting are more interesting for the filmmaker than they are for the viewer, and combined with the lack of narrative, that causes the film to drag a bit. I'm also not a huge fan of Jack Black's narration. It's kind of down to earth in a way that I'm sure some people will appreciate, but the style of it is so casual that it seemed sloppy somehow, maybe a bit amateur, and I found it somewhat distracting. And the plotting is just a little clunky, as the film's second half sets up a parallel of sorts between Stan's secret child NASA mission and the actual Apollo 11, jumping back and forth. The parallel works nicely, but the way the film sets that up could have been a bit smoother. On the whole, though, I am a fan of Apollo 10 and a half. Some of the most interesting bits are when we get Stan's perspective on the cultural events of the time. The strongest aspects of this film for me are when Stan is explaining what it felt like to be a kid during the 60s, when so much about the world was changing and so much was starkly different than it is today. During one segment, Stan talks about NASA and how futuristic everything seemed at the time. People genuinely thought that science was advancing so quickly that they could live well past 100 and be able to vacation on the moon within their lifetimes. But at the same time, there was this feeling of impending doom because of the Cold War and Vietnam, and there was also a real sense that the end might be near. It's one of the most compelling portraits of the 1960s I've seen on film. It's a decade well before my time, but I really felt that I understood this portion of history much better than I have before, because the film essentially helps us live there for an hour and a half. I'm very curious to hear the thoughts of film critics older than myself who actually lived through this time, and whether it captures a similar feeling to what they remember. The cultural divides on display are also quite interesting, though they only surface in a few moments. Themes of racial inequality and progressivism are briefly touched on in news programs the family watches on TV, and it's fascinating to see the differing reactions between Stan's college-aged big sister and his father, whose politics are a bit more traditional and old school. Many filmmakers eventually turn the camera on their own childhood experiences, giving us nostalgia pieces like this. But not every filmmaker is as obsessed with time and memory as Richard Linklater is, so it's not surprising that his version of a childhood nostalgia film is as unique as this film is. Ultimately, the film feels perhaps a bit small, a bit slight, but it's also incredibly sweet, and it absolutely carries Linklater's distinct perspective. Apollo 10 and a half is easier, though no less thought-provoking than some of Linklater's other movies. It's both a very pleasant time capsule of a film and an important addition to his body of work. Apollo 10 and a half, A Space Age Childhood is now streaming on Netflix, and I gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. Before we move on to our new series, I wanted to remind everyone that Arthouse Garage now has a Patreon. I love being a film critic, and I love doing this show, but it is not, thus far, much of a money-making endeavor. If you'd like to support the show financially and get some really cool bonuses, the Patreon is a really great way to do that. What do you get? Well, first of all, you get a special podcast feed with ad-free episodes, so you wouldn't be hearing this ad right now. You also get bonus episodes. I love having friends on to chat about all sorts of movies and TV in a bit of a less focused way. Recently, I've had Christopher Pistol on a bonus episode and Omaya Jones as well. There are also extended discussions. Sometimes podcast discussions go long, and I make sure to cut them down to keep them concise for the show, but the stuff I cut is often really good. You can hear the whole thing if you subscribe. And I've also started recording video anytime I have a guest on, so if you're someone like me who enjoys seeing the faces of the people you're listening to, the Patreon videos are perfect for you. Get all of that for the low cost of $6 a month and help support the podcast by going to patreon.com/arthousegarage now, or there's a link in the show notes. Seriously, your support would mean the world. And now it's time to start a new series. At Arthouse Garage, we love arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema, and those are roughly the four areas of film I try to explore with our film series, and it's time for some classics. This time around, the series will focus on classic films and provide a look at a specific movement within film history, and that is film noir. Film noir, if you aren't familiar, is a term used to describe films from the 40s and 50s that are dark, both visually and thematically. Most films that fit into the noir category are in black and white, with particular emphasis on black. Noir films typically contain a lot of dark imagery and many scenes taking place at night. And the subject matter of noir films tends to be dark as well. Gritty crime stories, often with a central character acting as a detective, living their lives in and around the criminal underworld. These are all general characteristics, and there are a lot of exceptions to these guidelines, but it's a movement in film history that proved hugely influential and still resonates in filmmaking today. We'll go into some more detail on film noir as a whole a little later in our discussion, but for now, here are the four films we'll be looking at in this series. First up, in just a moment in this episode, we are talking about 1949's The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed, written by Graham Greene, and starring Joseph Cotten, Alida Valli, and Orson Welles. Next time, we'll be looking at our second film, 1947's Nightmare Alley, from director Edmund Goulding. If that title sounds familiar, it's probably because modern director Guillermo del Toro's latest film is also called Nightmare Alley, and in fact, it's a remake, starring Bradley Cooper, Rooney Mara, and Cate Blanchett, and that came out just last year. But of course, we will be looking at the 1947 original. Third in our series of four will be the Humphrey Bogart starring In a Lonely Place, which came out in 1950 and also stars Gloria Graham, with direction by Nicholas Ray. And finally, we'll wrap up the series by looking at a more recent film, a film that would fit the term neo-noir, and that is the 1974 film Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski and starring Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. I'm very excited to get into these films, two of which I've never seen before, and I'm so excited to dig into them with the one and only Rance Collins. If you've never heard Rance on the podcast before, just know that he knows literally everything about classic Hollywood. He has worked for Turner Classic Movies in the past, and he runs his own podcast all about Oscars history called The Envelope Please. Link to that is in the show notes. Rance is also just a really pleasant guy to talk to, so I love having him on the show. And with that, let's get into this week's discussion of the 1949 film, The Third Man.
Is Mr. Martins engaged on a new book?
Yes. It's a murder story. It's based on fact. It's called The Third Man.
Thank you. friend I ever had. So you're going to find me the real criminal. Sounds like one of your stories.
You're wrong about Harry. You're wrong about everything.
Welcome back to the podcast, Rance Collins. How are you today?
I am good. It's been a long day, but I'm excited to sit down and talk about some movies.
Just nightcap with a little movie talk. Why don't you?
That's right.
You were here recently for the Oscars, and as we've done the last few years, it's kind of makes sense to have you for the Oscars. And then, you know, I love to do art house movies and indie movies, but also classic movies. And you're kind of my go-to person. And so this time around, we're doing film noir. And so I thought before we get into The Third Man, that we might just talk a little bit about what is film noir. I think 2 years ago, you and I talked about the film Double Indemnity, which go back and listen to that if you want to, listeners. But
didn't we also talk about Leave Her to Heaven?
We did, yes, which is you know, part of the Technicolor, but also is very much noir.
It's considered noir, yeah.
And that was the second, I guess, our second series last year. So yes, let's kind of recap what is noir for people who don't know, and kind of why is it so significant in cinematic history? It's one of those kind of genres not genre exactly, but I don't know how you'd actually classify that, like a movement of cinema.
It's a movement. Yeah. I like the word movement to describe it. I think it
comes up a lot in discussion. So yeah, what is film noir and why is it important?
Well, it started in the early 1940s. I think most people consider the beginning to be the Maltese Falcon in 1941. And it's just kind of this hard-boiled style of filmmaking that's very pessimistic and it's full of deep, dark shadows, not just in lighting, but in character. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the stories have to do with mysteries, crime, the underworld often figures in. There's a lot of examples you can point to in the 1940s. Double Indemnity, which you mentioned a second ago, has to do with a murder plot that involves adultery and insurance fraud and Los Angeles kind of on the dark side. A lot of times these movies take place in larger cities will have like a kind of Skid Row type area where some of the shady dealing can be going down. In 1947, this genre really, I think, started to go into what I would call real mainstream. You had a movie called Crossfire that was nominated for Best Picture that year. That I'm mentioning specifically because a lot of these films dealt with heavier subjects, sometimes in really interesting and subtle ways. Crossfire dealt with anti-Semitism. The source text it was based on dealt with homophobia, and they switched it to anti-Semitism. Wow. Semitism for the film. So a lot of times you'll see movies really have that edge to it where if you're listening, there's something else going on. Mm-hmm. I'm mentioning 1947 again because it's that period. 45 is when the war ends, 46, you got everybody coming home. And there's this real pessimism that really takes a predominant hold in movies in general in the late 1940s and the 1950s. That really rises into the 50s when you start getting like the teen angst movies like Asphalt Jungle and Rebel Without a Cause, some of which people could argue have noir elements about them that kind of leak in. But you also see that in some of the mainstream films that come out during this period that definitely I think have noir influences, like All the King's Men in 1949, which is dealing with the shady side of politics. Mm-hmm. So it's a blanket term. There's quite a few things that fall under the purview, and we're going to deal with four movies that definitely have commonalities in tone, but not necessarily story or location or any of the other details. But if you watch all four of them, I guarantee you're gonna go like, ah, this is what a noir is. So much of it is just seeing it, and it's an atmosphere, you know?
Yeah. And so as I understand it too, that the term film noir, which it's French, it means black film, right? So like it literally there's dark blacks in the film stock, but it wasn't a term that was used at the time. It's sort of been retroactively applied by film historians and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. And then of course we'll deal with one movie that would, I believe, fall under neo-noir,
yes,
which is kind of when there was a revitalization in that style of filmmaking in the 70s, when the work of directors like Francis Ford Coppola and Roman Polanski and Ridley Scott paid homage to these auteurs that they studied from the 1940s and 50s, and the whole auteur style became a thing, and they paid tribute in a lot to those movies from the 1940s and 1950s that were then classified as film noir. And so that was the neo-noir movement, which included films like Chinatown and Blade Runner. And I think you could qualify Taxi Driver and, you know, there's even noir elements in movies like The Godfather too.
Yeah, like any kind of crime underworld kind of stories. Yeah, and the next time we're going to actually look at the original Nightmare Alley, which again, obviously was remade quite recently by Guillermo del Toro, which I was a fan of the new one. I haven't seen the original, so I'm excited to watch that and kind of dig in. So yes, it's still a film movement that has a ton of influence even today. So I think it's very, very relevant.
Oh, for sure. And then there's also movies like L.A. Confidential and... Brick is one that I know a lot of people point to from, I think it was 2005, 2006, sometime
there. Ryan Johnson film,
So it is, there's also television shows. A lot of crime television shows have a feel about them that feels directly taken from that. Particularly, what was that one a few years ago, the HBO show with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson?
Yes, True Detective.
True Detective had a very noir feel to it. So anyway,
I've only seen the first season of that, but season three had a bunch of ties to Arkansas, so I need to finally catch up with that. Fun fact. But I think something that when I started studying film a little bit more seriously, one of the things that became really rewarding is just looking at film movements and how it's a reaction to things happening historically. So like you can look at, post 9/11 and things that were happening in cinema, or like all the paranoia of the 70s. And I mean, even now we have like post Trump era things happening in cinema, but like post-war World War II is so interesting. And I think like film noir was part of that, but even like, so we talked about a film a year ago as well, The Best Years of Our Lives, not film noir, but very much a post-war like film. And I think this film is post-war very blatantly as well, in some really interesting ways, taking place in Vienna in The Third Man. So I think let's get into The Third Man. So something that I always wish I had, and I kind of try to seek out now that I, am watching a lot more classic movies than I did, 10 years ago, but it's kind of like basically a TCM host intro, like someone who hasn't seen the movie, what do you need to know to kind of help you appreciate it more? Because if you go in totally blind, I've often had a feeling, I didn't appreciate everything about that I could have. So I thought maybe we could give a brief little spoiler-free. So we're going to talk about spoilers. We kind of have to, I think, with this movie. But before we get to that, kind of what do you think someone should know about this movie? I have a few notes, just like things to watch for, things to just a little bit of historical context to kind of understand why The Third Man is such a significant part of cinema.
Well, I'm always fascinated in the people who are involved. And this one is kind of an odd marriage between two different countries, because The Third Man is a British production, but you'll notice it appears on some American Film Institute list which is supposed to be just American films. And so there is an American claim to it as well, because it was produced by American producer David Selznick, along with the British producers. Is it Korda?
I think that's correct. I'm going to pull it up.
Quick. Alexander Korda, who was a very, very prominent British producer. And then directed by Carol Reed, who is would later win an Oscar for his work in the movie Oliver, which is very different from The Third Man.
I have not watched, it is Korda, by the way. I've not watched Oliver, but I actually bought a Blu-ray set recently that has Oliver part of it. And it's like the Columbia Pictures 4K restoration. So Oliver's in my future at some point.
We have an episode of The Envelope, Please, where we go over the best picture winner, Oliver.
I'm going to talk about some of the Criterion Channel special features, and one of them is an intro by Peter Bogdanovich, and he says, he mentions Oliver, and he's like, that's what he kind of became known for, because he won Oscars for it, but the phrase he said is, it's hardly a film buff's delight, that film. And I was like, that's a good way to put it.
That's very, very kind of him. It's an odd one. It's an odd one. If you want to listen to the analysis of why we think that won in 1968, feel free. Although my co-host is a huge fan of Oliver, and I don't get it. So you get two very different perspectives.
Wow. I gotta listen
on that one. The Lion in Winter was released that year, and that's all I have to say.
Back to The Third Man.
Back to The Third Man. Carol Reed. Very prominent, one of the most heralded British directors, working with David Selznick, who at that point in time was probably the most well-known producer in America. Mm-hmm. David Selznick, I'm sure we mentioned his name last year, but he was the first really successful independent, one of the first really successful independent producers of the studio era. So he came in, initially worked with both RKO and MGM, and then he struck out and did his own company in the mid-1930s, had a distribution deal through United Artists, which United Artists, their entire MO was to help independent producers release their work. And so he leased a studio that had been owned by RKO in Culver City. Most people will actually know what the front facade of the studio he leased looked like, because at the very beginning of any Selznick film, it says a Selznick International Picture, and it shows this colonial facade. And that is what the very first shot in Gone with the Wind is, for instance. The first shot in Rebecca. Those are two movies he made. Both of those won Best Picture. After he had a string of hits, he brought some really famous people to the States, including Ingrid Bergman and Alfred Hitchcock. He gave them their American debuts. And then after he had back-to-back Best Picture winners, Gone with the Wind and Rebecca, he kind of took a break and he didn't make a movie for a few years. And then when he did come back in 1944, he made a war homefront film called Since You Went Away. He did movies less frequently. And most of the things he produced were kind of to push his new wife. In this time, he left one woman and married this young actress named Jennifer Jones. And most of the projects he made after the mid-1940s were packaged with Jennifer Jones, including this attempt to redo the success of Gone with the Wind called Duel in the Sun, which is interesting and long and divisive. But in addition to doing that, he did occasionally produce other things, including this movie, The Third Man, which is probably the most significant artistic contribution that he made after his early 1940s, early 1930s, late 1930s into 1940 run. And the movie also stars Joseph Cotten, who was a collaborator of Orson Welles. He got his screen debut, I believe it was a screen debut, in Citizen Kane, playing the best friend of Kane. And by this point, he'd become a pretty prominent movie star. So you had him, and you had Orson Welles, who directed several other films, and there's rumors about what his contribution might have been to this movie. Although his directing career was a little on the skids by this point, because he had developed quite the reputation for not finishing and taking forever to do things. I think there's only a few movies that he made after Citizen Kane in the 1940s. I know Magnificent Ambersons, which got, no one knows where the real cut of that movie is. And then there's Lady from Shanghai and The Stranger. But Welles took this kind of small but significant role in this movie alongside his friend Joseph Cotten. And then we had this movie star that was under contract to David Selznick, who was going by one name at this point in time. It's Alida Valley.
As Valley, it says here on IMDb.
Valley, yes. She was a kind of an Italian that he brought over to America with the idea that he might do the same thing with her that he would do with Ingrid, that he did with Ingrid Bergman. And she didn't really repeat the same success. She was in a lesser known Hitchcock movie called The Paradigm Case that wasn't super successful. After this, she doesn't do much. I believe that would be too significant to American audiences. But this is probably the height of her career. And at the time, she was an actress that Selznick was really trying to push the star treatment onto. So there's some background on those people.
No, that's great. So yeah, lots of context as far as the players involved. Really, the few things I wanted to mention was just like Orson Welles. He's barely in the movie, but he's so good in it. Such a fantastic performance. Just the screenwriting by Graham Greene, which we'll probably talk about him a little bit more too, but it's so tightly plotted and so well written. Like, I do believe that this film is a masterpiece, and so much of that has to do with the writing. But then also just visually, it's incredible. There's so many beautiful shots. Like, I feel like every 10 minutes I was like, my God, that's a good shot while I was watching this movie. So be ready for a visual feast if you haven't seen it. And that's probably enough. So
it's gorgeous.
If you haven't watched The Third Man, pause the podcast and go watch it and then come back and we'll talk spoiler stuff. So from here on out, we're going to talk spoilers.
Spoilers.
So let's kind of get into the film a bit more. Do you have any kind of favorite aspects of this film as far as, whether it's, screenwriting or particular scene or performance or anything like that?
While you're talking about shots, can we just talk about how iconic the moment we first see Harry Lime, the character played by Orson Welles, when he's in the shadows in in that doorway. It's a, like a little doorway, right?
Like an alcove kind of thing. He's kind of...
An alcove, there you go. And it's a shot, I think it's one of those shots that anybody who's ever seen a montage of like the greatest moments in film, this is a shot they always include, because it's probably more so than maybe anything in Citizen Kane, the most iconic shot of Orson Welles. And the way it's dealing with... so many of these films have kind of, so many of the shots in this movie have kind of a Dutch angle to them. And it's like this obtuse way of looking at things. And you see it's the shots already angular and the lines in it are angular in the way he,
the shadows.
Yes. And the way he's illuminated. And that's just one example of a billion shots in this movie that are perfectly framed.
It's such a shocking moment, and because it's like, oh, there he is, and then like he makes the most perfect little smirk too, like the performance, and that's wordless, right? And he's just like standing there. That moment is so good, and the whole setup with the cat as well is really perfect, like just that's a screenwriting thing, I guess. But yeah,
I do like a good cat.
Yes,
as we know.
So I'll talk more about the different things like I researched in a minute, but one of them was there's an audio commentary on the Criterion, I think it's on the Criterion disc and on the Criterion channel, and mm-hmm. it is Steven Soderbergh. And
that's interesting that you mentioned Steven Soderbergh, because I, as soon as you said that, I thought about his movie Traffic.
I've never seen
and Traffic. How it feels neo-noir-ish to me, if you ever see it. Yeah. So
it's definitely been on my list forever.
It makes sense that he would be a fan of this movie, because that you can see the influences.
It's Steven Soderbergh and Tony Gilroy, the screenwriter who wrote like Michael Clayton and some of the Bourne movies and things, and they're like friends. So they did this commentary together, and it's very interesting. They talk a lot about those Dutch angles and the tilt, and of course they're both filmmakers, so they're like they actually go on and on and on about the tilted camera, like how does he decide when to do this? It seems like completely a gut thing, and it's so ballsy because like you have to like be very intentional, especially at that time, to set the camera because they're so big and heavy. Like you don't just try that on one shot. Like he knew exactly what he wanted to do when he was doing those shots. So that's just a really interesting thing that they talked a lot about.
Did you see the quote from William Wyler Mm-mm. on this movie? So apparently William Wyler was friends with Carol Reed, and he, after he saw the movie, he sent Carol Reed a level and he said, "Carol, next time you make a make a picture, just put this on top of the camera, will you?"
That's really funny.
But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, like, I love that question they ask in the commentary about knowing the right time to do it, because, you know, there's the other most famous shot in the film is probably the last shot,
which I'd forgotten.
And that's not
so good, but go ahead.
Oh, it's so good. And we'll talk about the story element of that shot in a second. But it's not a Dutch angle. It's a straight on head on. It's very straight, actually, because you have the way the road is framed. There's, you know, everything is very like
trees, and there's like, yes. There's like an arch or something. He's leaning on these bicycles on like just on the side of the frame.
It's a very vertical shot. There's nothing and it's not tilted in any way. And it's so interesting to think about that choice versus the many tilted choices that happen before that. And they're right, to tilt that would have not served the story, but somehow doing the Dutch angle in other parts of the movie completely work. And Carol Reed had a good gut.
Yeah they talk a lot about his previous feature, Odd Man Out, I think is the title of it, which I have not seen, but apparently there's a lot of even like thematic connections and visual connections to with a tilted camera and that sort of thing. So that's definitely on my list now to check out as well.
He also has another he made lots of good movies. There's also one called The Fallen Idol, which is really good, that he made the year before this. Has a Ralph Richardson. It's another noirish, noirish type. And it's just so interesting to me because Oliver is very different from this film. And, you know, it's much more traditionally executed. You know, it's a musical. So if they had done it like The Third Man, it probably wouldn't have worked. But it's just interesting to me that is probably more widely seen than this movie. And that seems unfortunate. Anyway, I wonder which one he would want to be known for. I don't know. He was nominated for this. He did get a nomination, but interestingly not a Best Picture nomination for Third Man. So
wow, what did win that year, do you know offhand? With 1949,
All the King's Men.
Okay.
All the King's Men. Actually, let me check on one little factoid. I wanted to make sure I knew what year it was nominated for, because it's a 1949 film.
Oh, right. But sometimes they
Oh yeah, it was. It's a 1950 is how they it, because of when it was released in the States. So it was nominated for Best Director in 1950, but that was the year that All About Eve won.
Mm, I see. Another film we discussed.
Those are three choices that are all exemplary, and I would not want to be the person who has to make has to decide which person deserves to win out of those very well directed films.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, yes, this is just magnificently framed. Mm-hmm. That's I think a large, you know, there's also the music, which we can get into in a second, which has the instrument,
the zither,
yes. which is a very daring, but you know, I was reading right before we got on about how Roger Ebert said something about, has there ever been a musical score that more perfectly fit a film? And that is so true, but it's such an interesting choice to make. Like apparently Carol Reed had heard this zither like playing in a club in Austria. And it was the only thing he felt was appropriate for the film. But, you know, I mean, how many other filmmakers would have just, you know, thrown those music decisions over to, you know, I'm trying like a Max Steiner or a Bernard Herrmann. And, you know, they would and they would have made scores that would have been sufficient. And we probably would have thought, oh, yeah, that score was great. But it's such a bold choice. To go with something this unusual, because it gives the movie a specific feel that I don't think any other film has.
Absolutely. I want to talk about the music for sure, because it is, it's almost, at first it seems almost whimsical, but then it does kind of ramp up in intensity and kind of the action scenes. It's also weirdly romantic, and the kind of,
I mean, think about how it's used in that last shot, you know, the way that it's the way that it kind of ramps up as she walks by. You know, like it works so perfectly. And part of the reason that works so perfectly is because you've been with this instrument the entire film.
Anyway. So the thing in the Criterion, again, I'm going to harp on the Criterion Collection supplements a lot, but they talked about, like, I think they had hired this guy who I can tell you his name, the person who plays the zither in this. And then, like, his story after the film too is really interesting. Right here it is, Anton Karas. So I think that they hired him for like a crew party or something like that, and the director heard him and said, this has got to be it. But there were so many reasons that it seemed like a really bad idea. First of all, it was the first time that Carol Reed had ever heard a zither played, and and he was like, you don't know if this is even a good zither player. He's just like a guy for hire. And then, it was so unusual to have one instrument for the entire movie, as you were just saying. One of the supplements on Criterion Channel is just a 2-minute video of him playing the zither in a club, like just at a gig. And I've never seen one. You get an up close shot of it in the opening credits of the movie. You see all the strings moving and everything, but it looks almost like an auto harp or something, where it's flat on the table, but it has like a fretboard, as well as like a spot where there, like, it looks like a guitar, but tons of tiny strings, like very, very unusual instrument. And he's like going crazy with it the whole time. It seems very difficult.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I don't know how people think up instruments, much less play them.
Invent that.
Yeah. Like, who invented the zither, and then who gave it? Why does it have that name? I have so many questions. I probably could have found out the answer to before the podcast. Some
homework on it.
But
based on the success of this, Anton Karas then went on tour, like in America and in the UK, like playing these songs. I think that what they said in the commentary is like he kind of knew he was having a moment that was unusual, like an instrumentation, like an instrument for hire, just suddenly in one of these, in a huge movie. So he went on tour, and then he opened a club called The Third Man.
The song,
yeah,
the theme from the movie became a hit too, like a hit song on like the Billboard charts.
Wow,
I know.
Interesting.
I mean, that does
pop radio.
I know it does occasionally. I mean, like, you know, the Rocky theme became a billboard hit, you know, it on occasion, something instrumental will do that, but it's rare.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know how rare it was in 1950, but
yeah.
Or 1949, whenever I guess America embraced the movie in 1950 based on the Oscars. So, the music definitely, it's a marriage of music and framing, you know, and I don't want to undercut any element, because obviously everything is firing on full cylinders here. Mm-hmm. You also have a screenplay written by a literary giant.
Yeah.
Which I think very, very greatly contributes to just how much the story itself works.
Yeah.
And the story is just supplemented by having great elements, but this is the type of story that if it was shot flat would probably still be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. I heard this compared to like other movies like Casablanca or things where it's just kind of a happy accident. Like there's no like one person that made this work. Everything came together. It really is like a team effort to make kind of all the different things work. And yeah, Graham Greene is someone who I studied in college. I was an English major and had a British literature class. And I think this is the only, maybe that's not true, but if it isn't the only, it's one of the few film things he did, but like this
one was... very few. There's only a handful. I'm looking right now.
Okay. I'm trying to remember what I read. We read, I think, a short story of his and then watched this film back in college. That was the last time I'd watched it, so I'd forgotten a lot of things about it. But it was conceived as a film. He went to Vienna. So first of all, the setting is so incredible here in post-war Vienna, because not only do you have just like visually, you have like bombed out buildings, and they kind of reference that in the opening. It's like an opening monologue thing. And that's just such an incredible backdrop. And like every third building is just rubble as people are just walking around living their lives. So like that's a whole post-war thing that's like kind of wild to just imagine living that way. But also the way the city is divided into a Russian zone, a French zone, an American zone, and a British zone. And then the opening monologue explains that they each had their own police, and then there's like an international zone in the middle that had an international force, and they couldn't really, because of that, there was so much crime that got through, like that slipped through the cracks. So that just such an interesting and rich setting. So apparently Graham Greene went to Vienna, and the way I heard it told was that he didn't have a lot of inspiration until like the very last day, and learned about the penicillin racket, which is a real thing, and also I think learned that the sewer system was huge. On the very last day, learned both of those things. Like, there it is. I can make my picture out of that. And so he then wrote a treatment that ended up getting adapted into this. So yes, Graham Greene, literary, incredible
giant,
and made this incredible film as well. Let me Nobel run through the
prize winning.
Oh yeah, yes, that's right. I was going to run through quickly just the different supplements that there are for Criterion channel subscribers or anyone who wants to go check it out. So there is the film, obviously. Then there's two commentaries, the one I listened to, which was Tony Gilroy and Steven Soderbergh, and then another one with a film scholar named Dana Polin, which I would like to get back to. Quick pro tip for people, if you're like me, you love audio commentaries and you feel like you never have time to do them, the cool thing on Criterion channel, or if you have, like, if you buy a movie on iTunes or whatever and it has the commentary with it, because I never want to sit down and watch a movie twice, even within a week or whatever. But if I watch the movie and then the next day I'll like put the commentary on like it's a podcast, just like have it playing in my headphones as I'm doing other stuff or driving or whatever, and it works out great. So I ended up getting through the whole thing. So there's two commentaries. There's also that treatment by Graham Greene. There's an audio recording of someone reading it, which is like an hour and a half as well. And so I did not have time to do that one. There's that great Peter Bogdanovich intro where he kind of does sort of a TCM intro style thing where he's talking about the film. There is Criterion has their Adventures in Movie Going. And so a filmmaker named Philip Kaufman talks about his reaction to this film. There's a whole hour and a half documentary about the making of The Third Man. It's called Shadowing the Third Man. Didn't have time for that one either. And then this one's interesting. In 2000, there's a half hour documentary that was commissioned by the Vienna Sewer Company, like, because this was like, I guess their claim to fame, that they commissioned this documentary to be made. And it kind of goes into the how the sewer was involved in the story.
Which is funny because apparently most of those sewer scenes were shot, were actually one of the studio. Few things shot back in a studio in England.
Yes.
Apparently because Wells didn't want to, Wells didn't want to, by the funny thing about Orson Welles is a fascinating personality to explore, but he, and we've talked about him before, but he was kind of, it didn't take him very long into fame to become a diva.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm not running through that sewer, those sewers. And they were like, okay. So they build sewers for him. And then apparently a lot of the shots in the movie are a double.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I
heard too. So they go to all this trouble.
It's like they get the AD. And actually what was funny about the body double, it's like the assistant director, and to get his like body frame, they kept the hanger in his coat to make it look like his shoulders. That was so funny.
Where his broad.
His broad, yeah. So yeah, a lot of that. There's so many great shots of just like a torso or like a silhouette running in the distance, which is so great, but
because Wells ain't there. That is the the sum total.
Funnily enough, he milked this for all it was worth, because then he played that character on the radio.
Yes,
as there's like a radio series. One of those recordings is on the Criterion Channel as well, that you can listen to. Or actually,
apparently wrote some of the episodes too.
Yeah, which is wild.
So he got a lot of traction out of Harry Lime. Now, those of you who finished the film may be wondering how Harry Lime could exist on a radio show after The Third Man. But apparently this takes place in a period before the movie.
Yeah.
This is a prequel series.
Yeah, before the movie happened.
People thought that cinematic universes were something of a recent invention and that stuff like The Mandalorian didn't exist. But this is... this is that just, you know, 70 years ago. Exactly. So there you go. Orson Welles, quite the character. That's, I just wanted to mention his diva way. Apparently he was also quite difficult to work with on this particular production. So
He would just like leave for weeks at a time. It sounded like,
Yes. And he seemed, most people involved seem to say that his involvement was pretty limited to what he worked on. Although I think he himself said several different conflicting statements over the years about how much work he supposedly helped with. And because of his involvement, a lot of people, I think, want to take credit away from Carol Reed. But this is Carol Reed's child, and it should be credited to him. Also, apparently, one thing that Orson Welles did add was the ad lib about what the Swiss
the cuckoo
have
clock
given
thing.
Us, the cuckoo clock. And apparently, that was just because of, for whatever timing in the situation, they needed one more sentence or the timing of the shot to work out correctly.
Such a perfect little ad lib. Then it's a. I love that. That's one of the lines I was like, oh, that's perfect. I got to write that down.
Although apparently everyone should know that the cuckoo clock was not invented by the Swiss.
a little bit of a misnomer there.
Apparently it was Germans were the first to give us a cuckoo clock. So the Swiss, I guess, are just known for them. I don't know. I don't know.
It's a great little line about, you know, we've had a messed up society, but look at all the art we've created. And what have the Swiss done? The cuckoo clock.
When we do meet, old man, it's you I want to see, not the police. Remember that, won't you? Don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. But what the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
That's such an interesting, oh my gosh, it's so interesting that we're repeating that right now, because it just clicked to me. Like, we were talking about at the beginning of this about how the film noir mm-hmm. was this art that came out of turmoil. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because this all was born out of World War II and its aftermath. Really, you're talking about mm-hmm. you're talking just a second about how much of this was filmed in the bombed out areas mm-hmm. of Vienna. That line that Orson Welles says could also double as the thesis statement for film noir itself.
Yeah. Wow.
You know? Boom!
That's amazing.
Boom! I wonder if anybody else
on the podcast.
I wonder if anybody else has ever drawn that parallel, or are we geniuses?
We must be geniuses. That's the answer. We should start our book about film noir.
Oh my God! Go. That's the beginning of the. That's the introduction. That's the first. The first paragraph is describing this about that line.
Well, speaking of the sewers and Vienna and everything, that one of the other supplements, there's just a couple more, is like archival footage of the actual sewers and like so the police are after him, and then these other police in like different uniforms come. There was actually a canal brigade of police that were specifically like, they dressed like sewage workers, but they were police, and they would like, there was so much crime happened in the Vienna sewers that they had their own police force for that. So that's in the Criterion stuff, which is interesting. Oh, there's a whole like 8-minute little mini slideshow documentary that has some interesting stuff. And then one interesting thing about the film too is that so our lead character is American, and there's a lot of other languages being spoken that he doesn't understand, and we don't get subtitles. So like that was a very intentional decision that we're kind of confused alongside him.
I love that. I didn't really think about the fact that we weren't getting subtitles, but it does.
5 or 6 moments where there's like a lot of other of like German and Russian being spoken that we just don't understand. But there's one of the supplements is some of those scenes subtitled. So like they had a version that was, and they decided to pull it. And so mostly it's the landlady at Anna's apartment building, who's always just mad about the police. So we kind of, and she actually was a pretty famous Austrian actor, from what I understand. And she, she's just kind of like in the background yelling mostly, but and she's just interacting with the police and is mad that they're searching her building and everything. But then there's some other, I'm trying to think of the other moments, but when he's talking to the porter, so that was interesting. So like there's a porter that's a big character who witnessed the crime, witnessed the, you know, when he got hit by the car, and did not talk to the police, and so he like, you kind of get the truth out of him, and then he ends up getting killed and all of that. That was a real like a non-actor that they found in Vienna, and his English really wasn't very good, so they kind of built that into the movie. And the first time you meet him, he's like, he gets heaven and hell mixed up, which is so funny. He says he could be in heaven or in hell, and he like, so that was a real. So we get a scene of him where we see what he's actually saying, because he's like kind of going in between English and German.
It's so good. It's so good that we have that, though, that we don't have that, I should say, because again, this is a mystery, and so for it adds to that element of mystery the more confused we are along with our main character, who I read in the novella, which is apparently quite similar, because he wrote the novella just basically to help himself write the screenplay. He didn't write it with the intention to publish it. It just ended up being published as well. He only wrote it as like an outline for the screenplay. And the one of the few differences is that the lead character is British, not American.
I missed that somehow.
The other big difference is the ending.
Oh, really?
Did you see that?
No, I thought you were going to talk about something about the film, which I'm going to get to, but go ahead and explain that.
Do they actually get
together in the end?
Basically there's another, I forget which character is narrating it. It's a first person, not from Joseph Cotten's character, or Orson, or
that's actually what I was going to talk about. So let me do that really quick thing, and then maybe it'll set this up, because there's, so in the film that is like the version that we get is there's an opening monologue with a narrator, and that's really the only narration we get, is that
it's an omnipresent, because it's Carol Reed.
Yes, it's Carol Reed's voice, right? It's a British voice, and he is he's clearly part of the black market. He talks about like the things he gets into, and it's like some guy. I like it because it seems like some guy just heard this story and he's now telling us. And he's on, and there's this guy shows up on the train, and then it cuts and we get into Joseph Cotten in the U.S. version, which is also in the Criterion supplements, and that's the last thing that's in those. We get the U.S. version as well, and it's actually Joseph Cotten's voice, and they cut it so that he's like not part of the black market, obviously, there in Vienna, and he's just like talking about it a little bit more omnisciently, and like then I showed up on the train, and it's definitely not as good. So I'm glad they kept the Carol Reed version, but
we need to talk about the differences, the American British differences in a second too. Okay. Because there were
some other things. Yes,
the cut that we see today is the cut that is accessible today is the correct cut of the film, but the original American cut was 11 minutes shorter. Trevor Howard.
Okay. Yes.
The ending of the novella has the two of them getting together. Basically, they walk away from the funeral and lock arms, and that is all observed by Major Calloway, who is played by Trevor Howard in the movie, and he narrates the novella.
Interesting. Okay, wow.
That's fascinating. The American version had several differences, just in terms of length, mainly, not so much story. David Selznick did want them to get together in the end, but Carol Reed thought for the ending that exists in the final film. But the biggest difference between the two is that opening narration is done in first person by Joseph Cotten and not by Carol Reed himself.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So in that commentary I listened to, they talked a little bit about like some of the small things they cut, which is it was for length, but it was also a little bit to make our American protagonist seem a little bit less like an ugly American, kind of, because he is sort of bumbling his way through this. He's not he's you know, doing a good job, but kind of by accident a lot of the time. And like there's some line about he's also kind of a drunk, and that's, it doesn't come up a lot, but here and there it does. So they cut out a few things, I think, to make him seem less like a drunk American bastard and a little bit more heroic for American audiences, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, but like such perfect casting though, because as bumbling as he is, there is something quite likable about Joseph Cotten, which is also why he works so well in if you've ever seen the Hitchcock film Shadow of a Doubt, which is another kind of it's noir-esque. I don't know if it technically qualifies. It is 1943, 42, 43, one of the two. It has him playing a character that needs to be likable so that later on when we find out things about him.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Yeah. Very likable. Yeah. Absolutely.
But still something kind of hard about him, which I think is,
in the noir setting for sure. Some of my favorite things about it are his banter with Calloway, Major Calloway, who's the British police major, which is Trevor Howard. And they kind of are at odds for the first, I don't know, third of the film. And then they sort of team up, and it's just some great witty banter dialogue lines at the beginning. And then, it reminds me actually we're the end of Casablanca, the beginning of A Beautiful Friendship, but kind of like that's kind of the vibe they have. Suddenly they're working together and solving this thing, and then he's like agrees in the very end to turn in his best friend, right? So the partnership there is really important to the story, and I think it works really well.
You know, it's interesting because Citizen Kane kind of deals with male friendship and betrayal of within friendship, male friendship, which isn't Wells, but it does carry on that theme.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, the disillusionment that comes along with, like, you finally find this guy, your best friend who you thought was dead all this time, and he's evil. Like, he's doing really evil things. Like, I love the Ferris wheel scene. They're in the carriage, and that's Orson Welles' biggest scene, where he's like, that's all his dialogue basically in that short scene. Yeah. But he has the whole monologue. He opens the carriage door and looks down. So we've at this point, we know that he's been involved in this penicillin racket, which is killing people and maiming people. And it's like a horrible, horrible thing. And he's like, how could you do this? And he points at all the, he's like, see all those little dots down there at the park.
Yes.
Like, say I make one of those dots stop moving and you can have $20,000. And like he is completely sold on the idea of what he's doing. And like, he knows, it's not like he just stumbled into this. Like, he's very intentional. And when you kind of realize that about it, it's so shocking, but such good writing.
Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why one of the lists that American Film Institute put this movie on was the heroes and villains list, the 50 greatest heroes and the 50 greatest villains. And he is listed as one of the 50 great villains. And it, you know, it's interesting. Another Orson Welles thing. He does a lot of what I would call cameo roles, starting in the late 40s. But there's another British film that he's in, the very different movie called A Man for All Seasons, where he has an extended cameo role, and it makes a tremendous impression. He just has this quality about him that even if his screen time is not, you know. Very few filmmakers also have that capability as a performer, you know.
Yeah. So he's on screen something like 8 minutes in this movie or something, which is insane. Yeah.
But he, you know, like Anthony Hopkins, Silence of the Lambs-esque, his presence is felt over the entire movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Something in the Peter Bogdanovich intro, he says, like, he's like friends with Orson Welles. He's like, yeah, Orson talks about this as like the perfect star performance because they talk about you for an hour and then you show up. And it's like, wait, we really have been talking about Harry Lime this whole time. And he's like such a presence, before he's physically there. And so that reveal is so powerful for that reason as well.
Yeah, Peter Bogdanovich, part of his entire career was built. He made friends with him and John Ford and all of the great directors of that time. And so much of his work in the early 70s in particular has like Last Picture Show and Paper Moon have such a feel about them that is connected to those directors that so inspired him. Also, interestingly, when he became friends with Peter Bogdanovich, this is just me throwing information at you for no reason at all. He was dating Sybil Shepherd at the time. And then in the 80s, Sybil Shepherd starred on a television series that called Moonlighting. That was the big launch for Bruce Willis as well.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd starred on the show. And it was a really big hit, and they did a black and white noir style episode called The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice. And it's a brilliant episode of television, but ABC, who aired the show, thought that the audience would be confused about it being in black and white. And because they thought the audience would be confused, one, the creator of the show made sure they shot it on black and white film so they couldn't air a color version and post and make it black and white in post instead. And two, they got Orson Welles, who Sybil Shepherd just happened to be friends with.
Oh, wow.
She was like, oh, I'll call Orson Welles to do a minute long introduction to this episode of Moonlighting. So the audience wouldn't be confused, which that introduction, I'm sure you can find on YouTube. This is also significant because he shot this the week before he died, and aired just days after he died. So that was the last thing he ever did, an introduction to a noir-like episode of a popular 80s television show.
There you go. And coming back to
there noir. You go.
What a,
I
what
did.
A perfect story to tie. That's great.
You get it there. But you mentioned Peter Bogdanovich, and that made me think of Civil Shot Ending Arc. So
I set you off.
You can't talk you about set me off.
Hollywood without setting rants off. Well, that's because another Orson Welles thing. So apparently David O. Selznick did not want Orson Welles initially to play this role. And
can't imagine they would get along.
Probably not.
There's like, if he couldn't get along with Hitchcock, I mean, there's no way he was getting along with Selznick.
And apparently there was talk at some point about Cary Grant playing that role, which I'm so glad that it didn't go that way. But
I am too. Although you say that, and part of me kind of wants to see it.
Just see that version.
Just to see what that version, because that's so different from anything Cary Grant ever played. But in anyway, interesting.
And then another kind of alternate casting thing was that Carol Reed wanted to have Jimmy Stewart as the lead instead of Joseph Cotten, which I also don't think would have worked as well, but I can see it in an interesting alternate universe being a...
You know why I don't think that works as well? Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, the Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant version we all want to see now. But I think it doesn't work as well because Jimmy Stewart is really famous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he has such a persona.
Yeah.
I think Joseph Cotten he was a popular actor at the time, but he's not like movie legend level. Mm-hmm. So I think that this role, you need somebody who isn't.
Yeah.
You know,
Steven Soderbergh talked about
untouchable.
That too. You need like a blank slate almost that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you come in and he needs to be likable enough, but also like in over his head. And that's like part of the character. Yeah. Whereas like,
Jimmy and you Stewart need, would, yeah. You need the Harry Lime character, whoever's playing that would need to totally overwhelm everything else in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you need somebody who can do that. And Orson Welles, I'm not saying he couldn't have done that with Jimmy Stewart in the role, but I mean, he would have been, I think, more on equal footing in terms of, of presence. You know what I'm saying?
Very interesting.
So, but because he has so much, he needed to be the thing with, he needed to be the person with the most screen presence in this movie for it to work.
Yeah.
Nobody else could take attention away from him.
That's perfect. Yeah. That's a really good point. Yeah. In some alternate universe, there's a version with Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant in a normal soundtrack, and it's not half as interesting of a movie.
Yeah.
That's what we have.
But we don't know. We watch it and we think it's really good, and we have no idea what could have been.
Yeah, you never know.
This
movie won the Palme d'Or at Cannes that year. That's interesting.
That's a really big deal. That's the biggest, pretty much the biggest international award for film, period. So
not a lot of Oscar love, but it did get that, which is pretty cool. I think that's probably my... kind of exhausted what I had to say about this film as far as, you know, production and everything. I just want to stress how good this is. Like there's some other, there's a few other shots I want to bring up. Like there's the balloon guy that shows up. Like it's like the most tense scene in the movie, and you see this as we've seen many times at this point, just like a really big shadow of someone kind of looming that's approaching, or we've seen them running away too, and there's all these shadows, and this guy comes up and he's carrying balloons, and you think it's Orson Welles at first, and it really kind of plays with you, like you don't think it is, and you maybe think it is again, but it's just a balloon salesman. But like it's the shot of him approaching, like, and that silhouette is was one of my favorite moments as well.
I mean, this is one of those movies where you could throw a stone at the celluloid, and you're gonna hit a great shot.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Don't throw a stone at the celluloid. I'm not advocating that. Let's not destroy it.
The reveal of Orson Welles we talked about, when they're in the sewers, like there's a whole chase. There's a few chase scenes, but like obviously the final one in the sewers is so exciting and kind of disorienting. And but then like when he almost escapes and he's crawling up the spiral staircase, and then he puts his fingers through this grate, and then there's a shot of above ground, and you just see his little fingers poking through. And I love that so much. It's almost like, you know, just holding on for dear life in a way, but also like what could have been if he had, you know, if we could, here, I'm going to get into my English major nerdy stuff, but like he's in his underworld. Like what if he hadn't, what if he had stayed above ground and lived a better life or whatever. And he's kind of like just poking his fingers and trying to reach that. That was a really cool moment.
Yeah. The way that we talked about filming this bombed out Vienna. You know, the way I think that the way that he frames the city, you know, where there's like these staircases that are torn apart and you're looking at these dilapidated buildings in the background, in a way, having all this stuff askew also feels representative of how the people within the story feel, you know, and the way the people within the place where they are feel. Like it's askew because nothing is like it's supposed to be right now. In that area, in that time, things are not as they are supposed to be. So the camera can't be straight because those stairs are supposed to be straight and go up normally and not, you know, pile in the middle. So it seems to be representing a few things.
Yeah, and I was just thinking as it ties into that final shot, which is again like straight up and down, like strikingly so. And it's like maybe with Orson Welles gone, now we've had his funeral, maybe like the world is set right a little bit. But then you think that on one hand, but then it's undercut by like the fact that this romance isn't working out, the fact that she's devastated. Like it's a kind of an ambiguous ending in a really good way. I think that the world is right, but is it really? You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, man, you could really get into this in so many different ways, because it's like why is that straight when so many other things aren't? And I'm looking at you just said that, and I Googled just to look at a screen cap of that shot, just to look at how, to just kind of figure out in my head how straight everything is in the shot. And it's really quite remarkable. It's because it's also the time of year. There's no leaves on the tree. So there's nothing even to break it up and add texture to it. It's just dead trees in a straight line. And she makes a straight line down that road goes past him when the whole rest of the movie has been askew. And I think that you hit on it a second ago. Maybe this shot is straight. Maybe this, everything is aligned in it, rigid, because this is the way things are supposed to be.
Maybe so.
And she's not supposed to be with him.
Even though he's missing his flight to try to make that happen. Yes.
Wow.
One interesting thing story-wise is that there's the cat moment, but there's a few different moments where this is something Steven Soderbergh brought up. So it's not an original thought, but like where an innocent bystander makes a big difference. So there's the cat that, you know, finds Orson Welles, and we found out that the only person that he likes is Harry Lime. So we see the cat, and it's almost a hint to us as the audience, like, oh my gosh, is he still alive? Is he there? And then there's a dog early on that kind of gives away that the doctor and the Baron are in cahoots. And actually, this is interesting. I didn't think this as I was watching it, but Steven Soderbergh talked about it as well, that you can almost see some gay subtext with those two characters, the Baron who carries the dog and he meets him initially, and then the doctor, it seems like they live in the same house. It kind of hinted at that. So that was just an interesting element to it as well. But
glad you mentioned that, because a lot of times I think I just see gay subtext and things just because I want to, not because it's there. So
like the dog is there, and then the scene that they brought it up again, this is on the commentary, was when he goes there at the end, is like, tell Harry to come out here. It seems like they've just woken up, and they both were sleeping there. So that's interesting, kind of wrinkle to it. And apparently there was something else that Steven Soderbergh talked about. He had just read a book about it when he recorded this commentary, but there was something else that was like, Oh, so he goes to the lecture, which that lecture scene is so funny because he at the beginning of the movie he's invited to we'll put you up in the hotel if you'll give a lecture because you're a famous author.
Yes.
And then he's kind of hustled into this taxi and we're like, oh no, is he in danger? And he pulls up and it's this lecture and it's this kind of joke. And then he goes up and I'm thinking, okay, is he gonna, he obviously has not been preparing for this. Is he gonna just go on the fly and be brilliant? But then he's terrible. Yeah. And everyone hates him, and the guy running it is just like holding his head. But in that scene someone stands up and says,
so good.
What do you think about James Joyce, or something like that, and mentions James Joyce. Originally in the script, the script said an effeminate man stands up and asks about Oscar Wilde, and the studio cut that. They thought that was like, they had such a tight, like that was just a little too gay.
It's too on the nose. The
yeah.
It's too on the nose. People would know what it meant. That's
thought that was interesting. Pretty interesting tidbit as well.
So instead they go with someone whose last name is Joyce to ask about. I see what they're doing there. Yes. I'm anyway. Sorry. I'm sorry, James Joyce, turning over in his grave.
I got sidetracked there, but oh yeah. So I was talking about there's the dog moment, the cat moment, the parrot that gives him away at that moment that he's hiding.
Animals, so yeah. Many animals.
And then also there's the child that when the angry mob turns on him, it's because there's a child who has seen him arguing with the porter. Now the porter's dead, and the kid tells everyone, this guy must have done it. It's like, this
but
yeah.
Good. There's, I'm sorry, you just made me think of something. Yeah. But they're all pets or children, mm-hmm. which that means that their control is determined by someone else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you're talking about, how a child, you're mentioning how a child gives them away. Mm-hmm. And you think about that as significant because these creatures that are trapped. Mm. are instrumental in potentially trapping someone else.
Interesting. Yeah.
Did that get there, or am I stretching?
Yeah, they're all kind of like, they're not being malicious, right? They're just being themselves. Like, this kid didn't know any better, right? It's like someone who's not really even part of the story is causing turmoil for our lead actor here. Yeah, interesting stuff. Yeah. Well, that is The Third Man. Very, very good film. Such an incredible movie. Please go watch it if you haven't, now that we've spoiled everything for you. But I think it'll still be an incredible experience, even if you, for some reason, listened without having watched it. But yeah, The Third Man. There you go.
The Third Man.
Next time we are going to talk about Nightmare Alley, the original version, which is 1947, I believe. I have not seen it before, so I'm excited to see it. I just recently have watched the remake, so I'm kind of watching them in reverse order. But
I would encourage people, I know it's a big homework assignment because the new one's 2.5 hours long, but I would highly recommend seeking out both versions because I have a feeling we're going to be doing a lot of comparing, contrasting.
Yeah, I'm hoping to rewatch actually the new one as well. So we'll see. And actually, there's a black and white cut of the new one, too.
I was about to say, you can watch the black and white cut because they have two different versions.
There you go.
But the original one is in black and white, and there is no other version. It's just in black and white. Tyrone Power, Joan Blondell.
And note on that, it's a little tricky to find streaming, actually. But as we've done before on this podcast recommended, there's a great bootleg on YouTube, which I can link to that I just looked at. I think that was the same situation for All That Heaven Allows. Like, they're
wonder just, if they tried to make it hard to find on purpose. That's so weird to me.
I think so. There's like a new Criterion physical copy came out, like I think in the last 2 months or something, kind of in conjunction with the new,
just don't have the remake. Streaming rights to it. Who owns it? I wonder.
I don't know.
Let's find out.
I looked at it on YouTube and it looks good. And that's what I'm gonna watch, and I'll post that link. But
amazing. There you go. All right.
Well, thanks so much, Rance. Couldn't do it without you, obviously. And always appreciate your time and your many wonderful thoughts.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And that's it for this episode. Thanks again to Rance for coming on the show for our film noir series, and you can see the video of today's Third Man discussion on Patreon. Next time, we'll continue the noir series with a look at 1947's Nightmare Alley, and the plan is also to review the new film from director Robert Eggers, The Northman. It's a Viking epic with a huge cast, including Alexander Skarsgård, Nicole Kidman, Ethan Hawke, Willem Dafoe, Anya Taylor-Joy, and even Bjork. It's a film I've been excited for quite a while, so I'm thrilled to see it soon. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.